Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Palm smells best in the evening. It's not worth believing what you heard. Soylent Green is really just a Triscuit, not a people biscuit. Take my word. It's been said you can't handle the truth, but that ain't so. How do I know?
Welcome to I Was There Too. I'm Matt Gourley. This is the show where I talk to people present in the greatest scenes of cinema history. Today, Paul Rust, one of my favorite guests so far. The movie, Inglourious Basterds, my favorite Quentin Tarantino movie so far. I love World War II movies more than war itself. Tarantino worked on this film for 10 years. He started it before Kill Bill Volume 1 and couldn't find an ending for it, so he just shelved it. Now, normally I edit these interviews down a little bit, but I didn't feel the need to do that today because Paul was such a delightful conversationalist, and everything was just very breezy and information-packed, including hearing about how Paul and the other bastards essentially had to go to scalping camp. So let's get right to it and connect Paul to last episode's guest. Johnny Roast Beef Williams to Robert De Niro in Goodfellas. Robert De Niro to Juliette Lewis in Cape Fear. Juliette Lewis to Brad Pitt in California. Brad Pitt to Paul Rust in Inglourious Basterds. That's it. That's all there is to say. Except to tell you that the title of the Jason Mraz song that I refer to in this interview is I'm Yours. And curtain.
The film, Inglourious Basterds. The year, 2009. The role, Private First Class Andy Kagan, one of the Inglourious Basterds. The actor, Paul Rust.
Okay, well, Paul Rust is here, and I have to confess some personal and professional jealousy because the type of movie I've most ever wanted to be in is like a World War II movie where there's just a squad or a unit of guys. Same thing with like the movie Aliens, where you go in, you're a band of brothers, yeah. You get the job done. My hat's off to you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, you want to be the men on a mission.
Yeah. It feels like they don't make those movies as much anymore.
Well, I wonder if it's partly, for me personally speaking, the man on the mission movie, men on the mission movie, usually there's the runt who's going to die. So I think maybe that's – you can watch like Star Wars and be like, I don't know what I would be in Star Wars. They seem – you know, but then like, oh, the guy who like gets shot in the head at the beginning. But I guess the thing with that movie is with Inglourious Basterds, it's all runts basically.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it. Yeah, the gang who couldn't shoot straight.
Right, yeah.
Speaking of your character and getting shot, we never find out what happens to your character, do we?
No.
Do you have any insight to that?
No, but it did cross my mind when I realized that I think my character stops at the veterinarian's office.
Uh-huh.
I don't move on from there.
Yeah.
And I remember when we were shooting it, realizing that and thinking like, so I started to like imagine like, do I just like stick around? And then I think it was a joke on set actually that it became its own movie where it was like, I decided to become the mentee to this like veterinarian and take like, it's like Cinema Paradiso where he shows me the ways, we become friends, he hands the veterinarian, you know, business to me. And then at the end, you know.
I would love PFC Andy Kagan, right?
That's yes, your, yeah.
And he inherits the veterinarian practice of this. That makes me so much happier than what I assumed was your end when Hans Landa says that they've kind of rounded up all the other bastards and that you're probably not alive.
Oh,
and,
that's probably
no. Let's
likely.
Go. With, no, we are going to absolutely. If in this movie they kill Hitler and rewrite history, it's pure license that we can say you get your veterinary practice.
We can have our own revisionism.
Yeah, you're still alive.
A movie,
as far as we know.
Yeah, 6 years ago. Yeah,
you're 96. Still, like, semi-retired. You're just overseeing. Some younger person is your hands.
Right. I'm carrying it. Yeah. Oh. I'm surrounded by, like, puppies. It's, like, the happiest setting.
Okay. Let's go to the beginning. How did you end up in this movie?
It was an audition, but it wasn't an audition that was, like, having to memorize sides or anything like that. So mm-hmm. It was a sort of a relatively low pressure audition because, it's a little easier to just be yourself. It was like a meeting, you know?
Yeah, so you weren't necessarily improvising lines or anything. He just wanted to get to know who you were.
Right. The second meeting was supposed to be improvised, and then it didn't end up being either. It was just like both times was just sort of shooting the shit. And I remember being relieved that I didn't have to, like, improvise because I'd say Quentin Tarantino's one of the great writers.
Yeah, but you're no improv slouch, I don't know. I mean,
I don't think there's any way that you could improvise, a line as a sewer rat might taste like pumpkin pie.
Yeah, what was it like sitting down with Tarantino for the first time? I would have been petrified.
Yeah, I mean, I was, I'm much like yourself, a huge movie fan, and he was somebody who, stood very highly in my mind as somebody who's like a great director. So to get to meet him, but at the same time, when you meet somebody like that, I think it's easier for me in a way to just default to who I am because I automatically assume the other person is a genius who can read personalities.
Uh-huh.
And so if I try to front or fake at all, they'll instantly see through it. So I'm like, all I can be is myself.
I don't know how you could succeed any other way.
Oh, that's only with him. Everybody else. Oh,
you're just living a lie?
Yeah. Living a huge deceit. It was like the two casting directors were sitting in on the meeting. And I came in and he just looked at my headshot and then looked at the back and looked at the resume and just started asking me questions about it, but he saw that I had done a Spike TV horror movie awards show. Like I had acted in a bit with Jamie Kennedy. It was like a The Hills Have Eyes sort of spoof.
Uh-huh.
And I was like playing like an inbred person with like a infected hair lip. And but I think because it said it was a horror movie thing. I think his interest was in that more than other stuff. So he was like, what was that about?
Did it say Hills Have Eyes on there?
No, it just said the Spike TV. Oh, and I think he maybe had done something for them previously. So it was like a shared. So then I just started talking about that. But then, I said something like, oh, I it was fun for me because I love horror movies, but you don't get an opportunity. Uh-huh. And then we started talking about horror movies. And I said, we started talking about this Italian horror movie called The Beyond.
Oh,
but I saw it because his film wing that he had through Miramax where he could re-release old movies, he re-released The Beyond. So it was just a conversation topic of like, I saw it in the theater in college because he had re-released it. And then we talked about this like handsome tin it came in when it came out on DVD. So
he probably loves you. No, but that's – you're speaking his language. It's crazy to me to think that – would you have ever thought that when you did that Spike TV thing that would be pivotal for getting you in a Quentin Tarantino movie?
No, yeah, that's funny. I didn't – because when you do something like – that it's exciting just when it begins and ends and you're just kind of like, oh, nobody would ever see that or it won't ever be remarked upon again.
But that'll get you in maybe the greatest Quentin Tarantino movie ever made. That's amazing.
Yeah, but I remember, that we just were having laughs about
about
horror movies. Yeah. But it was like, because I remember actually talking about how Inglourious Basterds, it was doing stuff about like, some of the characters do survive, like BJ Novak's character. He's a character who maybe at the beginning you think he would get killed, but he survives to the end.
It's very random,
And I was like, oh, it would be like the hot girl in a horror movie outliving everybody else. You know, the girl
virgin
who
dying.
Around. Yeah, the virgin dies immediately. But I think that actually became Cabin in the Woods. I think that's how that ends. So never mind.
But this was first, wasn't it? I think this was first.
Right.
Yeah, your analogy is apt.
So it was a first meeting there, and I had read the script beforehand. They let me read it, so just in case it came up and talked about it. And so we mostly talked about the script, and I just talked about it. I mean, I wasn't bullshitting. It was like an amazing script to read.
I'm sure, that's the easiest part, is you can go in and genuinely say, I love this material, right?
Yeah, you don't have to be like, I really want to be a part of your Spike TV horror movie award show.
But legitimately, because later it will pay off. Was the script different originally, or was there more? Did you have any deleted scenes that didn't make it?
No. I mean, when I was first in that first initial meeting, he had said, oh, the character I would cast you as, you don't have any lines. We might on the set find something and you could improvise something. But he said he knew he had a tendency, if he decided to start writing scenes for to serve every character, it would just become this kind of untenable movie, five-hour movie. And so I think he had put just personal limits on himself of like, oh, I'm just going to cast people who – I mean, in all honesty, because I never auditioned for it or, you know, it just was a meeting and I didn't have to like show acting ability at all.
Sounds like a dream audition.
I feel like I got cast mainly because it was like, oh, I don't want an annoying weirdo – hanging around set, this guy seems okay. And then also just having, I looked like I could be in the, you know, I looked the part. So I think I checked off those two boxes and I was able to, but I did read the script anyway, even though I wasn't reading for a specific character. But in a weird way, the reading of the script ended up being sort of like my, I don't know, the greatest way I experienced the movie, because once I saw it, you imagine other things it, or you just, you know, I'd had it in my head for like a year, so I thought it was going to be something different. Or also maybe because the scenes a lot of times hinge on like suspense, and if you kind of know. But I remember the first time reading the script, it was like the experience people had watching the movie, where you're like, oh my God, like I didn't know where that scene was, where it was going to head. But also I remember my main experience with it when I was reading it was, I would start reading a chapter, you know, a section of the movie, and then it would start wrapping up and it would end and a new one would start. And I think there's no way I'm going to get as invested in this next chapter as much as I did with this last one.
It's peaked.
Yeah, it's peaked and it's going to be boring. And I'd start reading it and then I'd get invested again. And it did it like 12 times in the movie, where you just keep getting invested with each chapter. And I was like, oh, that's amazing. Yeah.
I love it. It is my favorite Tarantino movie by far. I the World War II thing doesn't hurt, because I'm such, like, grew up watching World War II movies. And
I noticed on the poster for the podcast, there's a little army guy.
Yeah.
There. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that came from your love of war pictures?
You could probably say that. Yeah. I mean, if it were up to me, it would probably have been just a war movie poster. Why didn't I do that in the first place?
Some favorite war movies of yours?
Well, thank you, by the way, for asking me a question. I never get asked questions.
Yeah, I want to know.
Nice. Well, my favorite classic World War II movie is The Great Escape. It's the like, it's the happiest movie with the happiest soundtrack, where everybody dies in the end. Not to spoil it, but mostly everybody.
Yeah.
But Charles Bronson, basically.
Yeah.
The music itself is like bum 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 ba dum bum. And it's all Technicolor, and just like, it looks like it was shot on the same like production of Sound of Music.
Yeah, something. You're right.
But God, I love it. And everybody's in it.
Yeah.
And then Band of Brothers, like, oh my God.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah.
That's like, those are the type of things I wish I could do. You
yeah.
know? They're so great.
Well, my worry was that, like, you hear in those movies that they have like training.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
And I was like, oh my God, it's going to be like junior high football practice all over again, where it's gonna be really hot. I'm gonna be getting tired all the time and winded in front of like guys who are tougher than me. Because there's no greater like high school quarterback alive than Brad Pitt. So I just imagined
alpha male.
Yeah, right.
The Adonis.
But when I got there, there was no mention of it whatsoever. There was no like basic training, and I was like so relieved.
Yeah. It seems like Tarantino would be the one to go like, all right, that's bullshit. We've got some actors here.
Well, I thought because of Kill Bill, you hear about how they had to do all that martial arts stuff, but yeah. I guess maybe you can't fake that or something.
Yeah, that seems
but
like
I was like, oh man, those people I remember got all like fit and skinny and during Kill Bill. I hope I didn't have to have the same regimen. But we did do stuff where, you know, you like learn how to shoot a gun and
I have so many questions already. Yeah. This leads me to many questions. Yes. So I want to hear about the guns. I did read that you guys had to have scalping training. Is that true?
Yeah.
And that whoever did the best scalping somehow got close-ups on scalping? Or is that just some internet?
No, I think that's true.
Really? Yeah. So how's your scalping?
The scalping was we learned from this guy, Greg Nicotero, who's a special effects guy.
Yeah, I know that name.
He does Walking Dead now.
Okay.
But he did all these great gory horror movies.
This scared me because I thought you were going to say, we learned from this guy, blah, blah, who's a scalper. He's...
We brought him on. He didn't ever look you in the eye. Never got a name. But so it was like we did do like little workshops. And it was about, I remember, holding the scalp in place as you're like cutting through it.
Oh, so you're being trained on the special effects process of it more than anything.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, yes. But like there is a technique you have to keep it down.
Yeah,
I never
right.
even thought about that.
You would start like because if you're – pushing the knife through this is video cast, right? So everybody can see what I'm doing with my hands.
Yeah.
But you just push it through and then but if you push the scalp out of alignment, then it looks like you just set it on there. So the trick was, yeah, like holding it steady and then like peeling it off as the knife ran underneath it. But I think BJ Novak maybe got the honor of the close-up scalping.
Well, at the end, he certainly did. That's right.
Yes. Yeah. And maybe who's the first guy? Could have been Omar.
Do you think, though, that it couldn't be that who was the best scalper ended up being the person that lives with Brad Pitt at the end? Because that is very random.
Oh,
I mean, I'm
right.
sure they had to deal with that in contracts well before, but no. I want to believe
BJ
that.
Definitely had that part already. I guess I was thinking, is there a close-up when they're all in the woods?
Yeah, there is a medium shot where they kind of like it's in the foreground and that's kind of what your focus is looking at.
Yeah, so yeah, that person, I think, won the prize.
Well, hats off to him. So how long did you have to learn about scalping? Was that more than a day? Or?
Yeah, I guess that was like – I mean, because I wasn't in it a lot either and it was shot in Berlin, you would just kind of have like – days where you're not doing anything and you're just like in Berlin. So it would be like you'd maybe have to drive somewhere to spend an hour learning how to scalp. But then after that, then you would – I would just go to like the places that looked like America. I was like such an ugly American.
I understand that. I understand that. What did you do in your time off in Berlin? Looks like America? A McDonald's or what?
Yeah, I was just hanging out McDonald's and then I looked across the street and saw Burger King and I ran over there. No, I mean, we did go to like – there would be really great restaurants. There was a bar called Tarantino's.
Oh, my God.
That was a Quentin Tarantino-themed bar that people found. And then we just started going there at nights and stuff. But they had like, posters up of Tarantino movies and then like a jukebox that would only play songs from his soundtracks.
Did you guys let it slip that you were there shooting a Tarantino movie?
Well, Tarantino started showing up. He started coming.
Okay.
So they,
cat's out of the bag.
He loved it.
What if they didn't recognize?
Well, when I first moved to Los Angeles, the restaurant Birds.
Yeah.
Somebody mistakenly told me that was an Alfred Hitchcock-themed restaurant because there's a picture of Alfred Hitchcock up in there and it's called Birds.
Yeah.
Which led to like 2 good years of Hitchcock pun-titled dishes.
Do you remember it?
North by North. Eggs. I don't know. You put me on the spot. I didn't know. Couldn't remember.
Okay, so what was it like doing gun training? Had you shot any guns much before? Iowa.
Well, yeah.
You're from Iowa.
I grew up in the Midwest, so in junior high, I remember I got a – you could get extra credit in our science classes if you took a hunter safety course because the teacher was a big gun nut. That's what you want to be teaching high schoolers, sure, right? How to arm themselves.
And science, no less.
Yeah.
I would have thought that for like PE or something.
So I'd go hunting with my dad and stuff, so I would – I had shot a gun before, but it was definitely not in my the last 10 years of my life.
Yeah, I have a similar situation. Yeah. I was raised in a bit of a hunting family, and I remember like starting with BB guns and shooting birds, and then starting with like I'm a young man, and mm-hmm. I mean not even an adult, and I shot critters, and then there was like I would cry, and then there was this day where I finally went, oh my God, I don't have to do this. And I love my family. Like, they're not gun nuts or anything. Yeah. It was more of my extended family, but there was that. And my dad loved to ski, and so I was raised skiing. But there was this day, too, where skiing and soccer, I both went, oh, this is my choice. And then I've never done them since. I've never hunted, skied.
Oh, really?
Or I've played soccer, but yeah. Yeah, but it must have been fun a little bit.
They were old. They were like antique World War II guns, so getting to shoot those. I mean, knowing that they were, in the hands of non-fake, non-movie people who were shooting them in real life, you know.
Crazy.
But, yeah.
Oh, wait, did you get to shoot a machine gun, too?
We did the ones that were like the Rambo sort of
with a chain.
Like that my
ammo belt
movies is other movie. It's like a Rambo.
I'll bet it's an MG42. I know my World War II guns.
But that was crazy. Yeah, you're like shooting and it's like doing the thing where it's feeding through.
God, I'm jealous. I'm jealous.
Yeah.
I'm not a gun nut myself, but when it comes to World War II, for some reason, I want to strap on an MG42. That sounds horrible.
Well, I think it's because it was a good war, right?
Yeah,
you
right.
You feel like you're indulging in something that like would have helped save the world, right?
Yeah, I feel that. I think that's why I like World War II movies because, you know, people will ask me, have you seen Last Man Standing or American Sniper? And I'm like, I have no desire to watch my generation's war movies.
Yeah,
you know?
No, totally. Yeah,
it's
yeah,
depressing.
Yeah. and also that it was like I remember when we were shooting it thinking because the movie seems so sort of irreverent, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That it was being revisionist and stuff. I everybody thought they were making something really awesome and stuff, but I didn't think it was going to be as revered as it was because I thought it was so not reverential not that it was thumbing its nose at World War II, but it just was being a lot more playful. So I was like, oh, it could never enter the world of an Oscar caliber war movie.
Oh,
you know,
interesting. How did you know like there would be that kind of real spaghetti Western element to it? I guess that's kind of in the script with the chapters and stuff, but
yeah, I mean, it wasn't, it was cool because you would, be able to, walk onto set and see kind of just like how the lighting was that you would be like, oh, this is amazing. I can get the vibe of what this was. And yeah, I mean, there was also just impressions you would get with, the first impression was like at they had a table read and that was great because it was all, I think every actor who was doing it with exception of maybe, I think like Mike Myers wasn't able to get there. And Quentin read his part in the table read of the British officer.
But because that was originally supposed to be Simon Pegg, I read. I think maybe last minute had to be replaced.
Yeah,
and that's probably why.
Yeah, so they were like, replace a funny man with a funny man. That was awesome. The table read was awesome because it was the first time everybody heard Christoph Waltz read the part. And it seemed like when you read the script that it was like this impossible part of, you know, somebody who had to speak multiple languages and be scary and be really funny and charming. And I mean, not that it's any surprise, but when that table read was over, that was all people could talk about was how amazing he was.
That's all I could talk about after I saw it, too.
Yeah, yeah.
I also read that – you never know if any of this is true, but that Tarantino had kind of written this part and – sort of wanted to shelve this movie because he thought I wrote a part that no one can really act. And then when he saw Christoph Waltz, he had it. Yeah.
Yeah. That seemed to be the impression that I was getting was that like, it was a struggle to find somebody and then just this miracle happened. But also with the like multiple languages thing, I remember an interesting day where Quentin had come in and he was talking about how he had to sit with a translator and rewrite all the dialogue he wrote for, because when it's said by a German,
yeah,
and just how that was a trip for him, because it was like when you write something, I guess, you know, you have an under, like, oh, there's two D's in this word, so there's like an alliteration,
oh,
or
yeah,
like just
yeah.
the rhythm of it.
Yeah.
And so, like,
especially for someone who has such a rhythm and vernacular as
yeah,
it is. Yeah.
And a command over like dialogue that yeah. like, I think it was like an unusual experience then to be like semi kind of throwing it all out just in terms of how it sounds and then just rewriting at the bottom of the screen.
But, yeah. yeah. Well, I have a question about Christoph Waltz because he's, you know, amazing. He's brilliant.
Yeah.
And then I was watching Big Eyes and I noticed like in a lot of the movies, he kind of has a similar delivery to Hans Landa. And I'm wondering, is he just kind of like that? And he's probably brilliant, but also maybe he's just kind of like that. I don't know, a little weird. Where he does these things and your delicious milk.
That's good, man.
Oh, well, thanks.
yeah, I did get the vibe that, I don't know, it's probably like one of those things where yeah, somebody brings them themselves. When I met him and stuff, he was a very joyful guy. You know what I mean? So that giddiness you're getting is probably real. Yeah.
Yeah, it feels like he's so happy to be in these movies that somehow comes through.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Well, the joke I make whenever I see him in a new movie, like Big Eyes or something, it's like, oh, Tim Burton had been wanting to work with him for like 15 years.
Yeah.
And then he finally got the opportunity. Like, that guy, deservedly so, like, you know, Quentin was this guy's in movies.
Yeah.
Quentin discovered this guy, you know, and then like, it's like anything, mostly with Quentin, which is like, then everybody just comes in for the feast and the.
Yeah,
like,
he plucks people from relative obscurity, or at least they were once famous, even like Travolta.
Yeah, and like John Travolta would have never been in Face Off.
And he totally squandered the opportunity in many ways.
Twice, that guy.
I liken it to Bush after 9/11, where he got everybody on his side and then just ran it back into the ground again. Travolta and Bush.
yeah, remember that part where somebody, John Travolta was reading a script, right? And somebody came in and whispered to him, you should do Battlestar Galactica. And then
he waited 8 minutes. And
that's not the most perfect comparison.
I'm already envisioning that. I don't know if that's like a sketch or what that is, with Travolta reading a script in front of children. And then an aide comes in and whispers to him, like, you have the role. And he sits there.
Just reeling for like 8 minutes.
Oh, how do we make that happen? That's good. We're going to take a small break and we'll come right back.
Cool.
All right, we're back with Paul Rust in Glorious Bastards. One of the crazy things about this podcast is when I rewatch these movies, I'm watching them for one character's perspective, which completely changes the movie, like aliens for a colonial marine. And watching just for you is so fascinating. So I never noticed before when you guys go in to break Hugo Stieglitz out of his cell.
Yeah.
The way you walk up and the way you stand has so much like football bravado. And you have this like slant, like basically it feels like your character's going like, what are you going to do? What do you want? Right? Then you shoot that guy, right? The groaning soldier?
Yeah.
But you don't even look or flinch barely. Like you just – and this brings me to the pleasure of this podcast is I'm watching the whole picture normally and then I'm watching you and I get this whole nuanced performance of this
Oh, that's
PFC
great.
Andy Kagan, who doesn't barely even need to look to shoot a groaning, wounded soldier.
Well, thanks, man. Not many people have noticed that, and that's actually my biggest part in the movie. So for you to notice that, I appreciate
it. It was hard. Yeah. I mean, I always noticed that there was the comedic shoot, the gunshot, but it's
it's hard to read necessarily that it's me or You get more of the sound, the rhythm or something. Well, that was a... I haven't thought about this in a long time, but that was actually and wasn't even a thing in the back of my mind to bring up. But
oh, good.
Yeah, it was like that actually came out of – I got that because Brad Pitt came up with the joke of something we kill people, and he's like, it'd be funny if somebody groaned and then somebody shot him. And then by, I think, virtue that I was further on the left, I got that joke. And then it became all about, oh, you can't – it's going to be really loud.
Because you're in this like cave chamber.
Yeah. So it's
right?
like cavernous where it's just like all echoes. Uh-huh. And it was a former like Nazi headquarters. Like, so there was, I remember stuff torn down that used to be old, like, you know, like maybe a statue that, you know, after the war was over, they're like the shit out of here, but it was still like there. But yeah, I remember shooting the gun and they said, oh, make sure whatever you do, don't, bat an eye because it'll be funnier if it's just still. So that's what
impossible.
You saw. But I remember when I was done, you know, and people are done and then you just kind of like walk away. You're like, I hope that worked out. And then I remember like a half hour later, Quentin came by and he was like, man, you nailed that gunshot thing, man. That was great.
You did.
That was a high compliment.
I'm not even joking. It's worth rewatching this movie just for that little scene.
Well, I remember that. Yeah, when we did it, it was actually that for me, that felt like it was really exciting because it was the everybody's in the frame together, walking together in a line. It looks like the classic sort of like group of guys formation that you see.
Yeah, and, it would be on the poster, the tableau, the silhouettes of the guys. I watched the trailers for this again because I even remember when these trailers were coming out and the movie hadn't come out, I was so anticipating it.
Yeah.
And I remember Sam Levine running down the hall with one of those full belt machine guns in the trailer. And I watched it again, and he is in there. So that was there more to that assault that was cut out? Or
the Hugo Stiglitz breakout was that was that's what it was a part of. And I remember I think they had like they set up a I remember them setting up and us watching – the like the playback of Sam running down like shooting it and we were just like, oh, this is gonna be in the movie. This is awesome. This is like the cool this is like the image of the movie. It's like this like guy with
a little guy
with a big gun. Like and then I remember when we were shooting that day, Quentin kept saying, I just wanna go crazy here and just shoot like a big breakout scene. And he started having ideas. And then it was, again, sort of like self-restraint sort of thing where he – I mean, a lot of the – just a little background. It was like they had announced that the movie was going to be at Cannes, I think, before they started shooting. And so it was a really tight schedule. Like they were going to have to shoot a lot and get it edited in time. I think because we were shooting in September or October – and then it was premiering in Cannes in May, so it was pretty short shoot. You know. So there were times like that where it was like, oh, this would have maybe been a longer sequence if he had time to play, and so maybe he was shooting some stuff here and there as possible, you know, things that he could slide in. But it didn't happen. But but when I saw it in the trailer, I was like, oh, it's guaranteed to be in.
You know? I know. Well, maybe they didn't. I don't know if it got cut from the movie or they didn't know it was in the movie and they're at least, let's put it in the trailer because it's such an amazing image.
Yeah, yeah. I remember that trailer because it was exciting that that there's the lineup where he's talking to us.
All and, bastard stuff. And I was surprised when I saw the movie how the other chapters were, you know, like I thought it was going to be just all a Dirty Dozen type movie.
Me too. I mean, when I first read the script, I remember being really surprised. I just in my mind, I thought it was going to be, like – each guy gets his own chapter sort of thing. And I mean, I guess it's a credit to the originality of that movie.
Seriously. So how is Tarantino as a director? Did he give a lot of acting notes or is he more just let you guys play or is it, I mean, there's so much technical stuff you have to worry about in this movie, I imagine.
Yeah, I remember he, I certainly got the vibe that he loved actors and loved working with actors and like had a lot of respect for what they were doing. And, you know, I remember when we were rehearsing the veterinarian scene, somebody said, oh, it'd be good if the light got bumped maybe and by somebody's head. And so on a couple of rehearsals, I would hit my head on the light. And I remember Quentin, after a rehearsal, being like, hey, man, thanks a lot for doing that. You know, I think he could tell, like, oh, this is an actor trying to make it work for me or whatever.
That warms my heart, I have to say. It seriously does. Yeah. I love hearing you two got along. I do.
But, yeah, he was very, like, kind and considerate towards actors and wanted to know what they were about. And, like, also, we had just noticed while we were on set that it was a lot of comedians, like funny guys, and also a lot of writers. Like, we were all I remember I was writing a script with Charlene Yee at the time. While I was there, we were kind of working on it. And then BJ Novak was writing on The Office, and Michael Bacall was a writer, wrote Scott Pilgrim, was writing Scott Pilgrim and 21 Jump Street.
Did you guys know each other previous to this?
I knew BJ, but I didn't know Michael. And then Eli Roth is a writer. Right. And so, yeah, it was like – it did feel like people were cast because he wanted to have some sort of creative actor energy, you know.
That's so great.
But I mean, it was cool to see him, you know, like, again, in like the vet scene, it would be kind of like – I remember a moment where like they're like, we're going to go bust into the theater, right? They're kind of hatching their plan. And we all, like, all the actors kind of, like, smiled and, like, looked at each other, like, yeah, we're going to go to the theater. And then he was like, no, you guys are, like, scared that you have to do this. This isn't, like, exciting. And I remember thinking, like, oh, I guess that's probably, like, what a good director does is just, like, lets you – like, I'll see movies where you'll see a close-up, and I'm like, that's weird that that person's doing that. And then I'm like, oh, probably because it was not a great director being, like, you shouldn't – that doesn't make sense for you to – for you to do that. But I also remember that scene. It was kind of like, yeah, and then somebody hatches the idea, but then somebody brings up that it's not going to work, you know? So, you know, one of the characters basically like, hey, let's not just start sucking each other's dicks quite yet. And that's a line from Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, that's right.
So Quentin was quoting a line from Pulp Fiction to help explain what was going on in the scene in Inglourious Basterds.
That MO doesn't surprise me. Yeah. He doesn't shy away from the fact that I think he's his biggest fan. And merited. Like,
totally merited. Yeah. And like that's like that was my takeaway, I remember, after we were done shooting, was I was like, it was actually really, really inspiring to see somebody making the thing that they just wanted to see. And there was zero like, are people going to get this? Or am I going to have to show this first to somebody who's going to disapprove of this? It was just like a guy doing what he wanted.
That's why I do podcasts. There's no podcast overlord. You can say whatever you want right now and we can put it out. Did he do a lot of takes, or is he just kind of – there's like the Kubrick side of the spectrum and the Clint Eastwood side of the spectrum. All right. Fake baby one take.
Yeah.
Shelley Duvall drawn to madness, 100 plus takes. Where would he fall in the spectrum?
Yeah, it seemed more like we'd get to like 7 or 8. And a lot of times it would be like, and there could have been more. But, you know, it is all about sort of like keeping the energy up. Like he'll play music during setups and stuff. He'll just like put on soul records.
Really?
And like, I wish every set I'm on, I wish somebody did that. I wish somebody would play music because it does get kind of quiet and weird and it just keeps people happy and moving. And
there's so much downtime.
Yeah. And he'll also like every 100th head of film, you know, when you go through like the stock or whatever, he'll break out champagne. So like the 100th, the 200th, and they'll break out champagne and everybody drinks it, has a good time. And then like if you do like – it's funny with the Kubrick thing because it's like if you do more takes like – and I think there's always like a somewhat like pressure when somebody's asking for more takes because people go, oh, is somebody not getting this right or who's fucking up?
Oh, yeah. Mind games, I would imagine. Yeah.
And, you know, he's just like a good reader of moods and energies and stuff. So if he can kind of feel like people getting a little down or something, he'll go, we're going to do one more take. And why are we doing another take? Because we love making movies. And he has everybody say, we love making movies, like just to get energy up. After,
oh, my God.
I feel like I'm blabbing. I'm sorry.
Are you kidding? That's why you're here. I feel like I'm stopping you from telling you.
No.
You are in the right place. You're doing exactly like I said to you off mic. You're my favorite type of guest.
Okay. But yeah, because the other thing I remembered was if you nailed a take, that was the Jessica Simpson. And if he was going to ask for one more – that maybe wouldn't be as good as the last one. We're just going to see if we could. Was called the Ashley. So it'd be like, we'd be done. And people go, I think that was the Jessica. And he'd go, okay, but let's see if we could get an Ashley. Yeah,
so. What would it be if you ever topped it with the second, with the.
Oh that's good. God, then I guess it Aguilera. Would be Lisa.
Yeah.
Simpson. but that's good. So that there was like always kind of just like different ways to make sure people were having a good time.
Speaking of the music, I read this in multiple places that when he was writing this film, the music he most often listened to was Jason Mraz. Does that blow you away?
Yeah. No way.
Yeah, specifically one song. I forget what it is. Oh, I can look it up. But the thing I love about him is he is so not afraid to go anywhere that feels right, you know?
Yeah.
A lot of people would have trouble going.
Well, just even the Cat People song, the David Bowie song plays at the end and stuff.
It's
like
incredible.
It totally works.
He has that, he's done it himself, but he has that brilliant luxury of having built a career off of like restoring kitschy novelty to the point of cool. So
yeah,
he has free license to like any kind of shit he likes, and it immediately becomes cool. And
right. And if you don't like it, then there's probably something you're not getting.
Yeah,
about
right.
It. That's like
yeah.
the thing you have to kind of go. Then it's like, wait a minute, I didn't like, I didn't think Wild Wild West was a good movie. That's not what.
No, Lone Ranger. I think it was.
Oh,
he loved Lone Ranger.
Yeah, thinking of he loved Lone Ranger.
But who knows if there's even an Emperor's New Clothes factor? I just like, okay, I'll take it. I'll buy it. That's amazing.
Just talking to him, it would be like referencing. I remember like the shot where they're in the forest and they've just carved into the head of the forehead of the guy, and then the forehead of the guy, and then it's like it's his point of view kind of pointing up, and Brad Pitt and Eli Roth are kind of like looking down.
Oh, at the end, you mean? Or in the one where you guys are all out there?
Yeah, we're all out there, and. I remember he was like, oh, this is like the last house on the left.
Oh, wow.
And so you're like, oh, he even – when you're on set, you kind of just go, this is what I have in mind, last house on the left. And then it would be like, what kind of men do we have on it? Our top men. So he's like quoting Raiders Lost Art too. It was just like so fun. I mean, being around a guy who just like loved all kinds of movies, loved like weird – rape revenge exploitation movies to like the most popular movie of all time.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
The scene where Eli Roth beats Sergeant Rockman with a bat, and that guy plays that Richard Sammel. He's amazing. The intensity, and then he has this like strange sympathy. I mean, he's a German soldier and
I know, but he's almost like beatific in a way.
Yes, and then the way Eli Roth looks at him and he looks at him, it feels like Tarantino said, play it like a love scene or something. Yeah. How much do you remember of being there that day? Was that intense or?
Yeah, that, because like you know that it's like a violent scene and one that's going to be probably really effective, you know what I mean? And to watch, like, sort of see somebody, like, I guess what was cool about it was you could just tell everybody wanted to do, like, a really good job because they liked the movie and they want to impress Quentin and stuff. Yeah. So, like, you would see these, these German actors who were, like, day players and just come in and, like, blow the roof off because they came to, like, kill, you know?
Yeah,
like,
that guy's incredible. Yeah. He actually is in one of my favorite movies, Casino Royale.
And oh, he is?
He's in the end, the guy with – instead of having an eye patch, he has one sunglass and one regular lens in his glasses. And he has the knife and he holds Vesper hostage at the end. He gets shot with a nail gun.
Oh, my gosh.
But I didn't even recognize him until I did this research. That's crazy. I always thought, like, Remember that guy in Raiders of the Lost Ark that plays the head Nazi, not the guy that gets the, not Tote, but I forget his name. I thought it was him for some reason, but he's probably too old.
That'd be great, just casting all guys who played like German baddies in other movies.
That's how it was in the 80s, though. That's why I loved World War II movies, because it was the same actors that would play the Nazis every time.
Well, then we would talk about the big red one, with the...
Mark Hamill. Yeah, that's right. Oh, God.
But yeah, I remember like shooting that scene with them when they're like pointing at the map.
Yeah.
And they kind of like, it's a complicated, it doesn't look it, but like.
I noticed that
You're following their finger up to their eyes, back to somebody else, back to the map, and you're following their finger.
Yeah, it's like a triangle three times with the shot.
Yeah. And that was such a cool thing to watch, because that was just like organically, like the first take they didn't do that. And then the second time it was like, well, what if we just panned out on the map for that moment? And then
do they have to change focus every time they whip pan down there?
Or the DP was this guy, Robert Richardson, I think is his name. And he's he's won a couple Oscars, and he worked for Oliver Stone, and he's Martin Scorsese's guy, and he's worked with Quentin before. So that was like the collaboration between the two of them was like the coolest thing I saw on set, was because it would just sort of be like them, Quentin being like, hey, could we do this? And he's like, yeah, I think we could do that. And then they would figure it out. And like, yeah, maybe the first time it was just like one triangle, and then they would build it to two and then three. And like, it was like, I remember then when they called cut and they got it, everybody started cheering.
It must have been
like, hey, we nailed this. And you know,
the timing, even the actors having to really kind of be aware where the camera's going.
Yeah.
That was the Ashley Simpson for sure. Speaking of collaborators, this is Tarantino's last film with Sally Henke, his editor that he worked with a lot. And I guess these films are known for the actors after certain takes doing a hi, Sally.
To say
hello to her in the editing room. Did you wear?
I never got to do a hi, Sally, but I did get to meet her. She sat in front of me at the premiere.
Oh, I wanted to talk about the premiere. How was that?
The premiere was awesome. Yeah. I remember
I got to meet
Kanye West at the premiere.
Really?
Yeah. But it was like it was the first time I had been at a premiere of something I was in, and I remember like. Oh, yeah. Ugh, this is like, you know, if it's not, I feel uncomfortable like when I go to a wedding and the person whose wedding it isn't is the one who's like dancing really big at the reception.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of like, it's not your wedding,
right,
dude.
Right.
You're just getting a little out of hand here. Yeah. So that's how I felt like, I think at the premiere, I didn't want to like be walking on like, you know me, everybody.
So me and Brad.
I walked onto the red carpet. And I stood there, and then I looked over, and I saw Samuel Jackson, like, next to me getting his picture taken. And I just turned around and walked off the red carpet.
No.
Yeah, I was like, I'm not going to do this.
You didn't even go all the way down?
Nope. I turned around, and then I, like, slinked into the Chinese theater. But that was cool, because I remember, you know, when you're reading something, you just have to imagine, place it somewhere in your mind's eye.
Uh-huh.
So the premiere of Nation's Pride, where Hitler gets killed in the movie, I just imagined at the Chinese theater, because I'm like, that's where they have premieres, and then that's where the premiere was. So
that's crazy.
Yeah.
I read, too, that theater that they built for that premiere is based on the Vista, which is near here, the one on Sunset.
Oh, no way.
Yeah,
that's
Silver Lake.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's cool.
I totally saw that now.
Yeah, it was at this place, Studio Babelsberg, I think was the name of the studio. And it was one of the oldest studios in the world that was still like running. And they had shot Metropolis.
Oh my God.
Like, but then also like The Never Ending Story. So it was like,
the two greats.
Yeah.
I know what you're talking about.
But yeah, that was cool, like being on the set and stuff, because that's where I remember us walking in while they were constructing the hotel set. And it was really awesome. Yeah.
I know. I have one more question about your first scene, the big briefing scene with Brad Pitt.
Right.
So how long did you have to stand still? And it must have really been like being in the army, because you have to stand there. And was that tough? I know that's a silly question,
no.
But it seems like it would have been very difficult.
It was tough because it was like really cold. And then I remember too, like, you know, when they changed the lens and it keeps getting closer and tighter, like it reads more movement.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Like it's just a hair you're like a hair off from blocking like Brad Pitt's head. So it's like even more high stakes of wanting to stay still because this person's like delivering a monologue and you don't want to be like, hey, shithead, you know, like stepped into your light, you know. But I remember they were setting up the big wide shot looking down on us and my pant leg kind of got like pushed up so my sock was showing.
Uh-oh.
And Quentin went, hey, Rust, pull down your pant leg. You look like a dork. So that was my big memory of that scene. But no, it was – and that was cool too because you were getting to see like what Brad Pitt was doing with the character and like
– Yeah, how was it working with him? Was he a nice guy?
Oh, yeah. He was I mean, if he was an asshole, I wouldn't say.
Because, sure.
But it wouldn't be good. Yeah. But no, but genuinely, all truthfully, that sounds like I'm saying that to say that he was.
No. Paul is not winking at me right now.
I'm not. No. He was an awesome guy.
He seems like it.
Yeah, it was like everything you wanted to be. And like we joke on set about how like, you know, he would be like, you'd see him in a jacket and you'd be like, I wonder if I got a jacket like that, how that would look. Like, you're just, like, totally reduced to, like, the friend's older brother who's,
that's
like, really cool and
has.
You just want to impress him. And,
yeah.
But he was great. I remember he was, like, he was no diva. It would be, like, he would just hang out on set and talk to people and hang out. And I remember, you know, I think it was a day that it was, like, me and BJ and Eli, we were shooting a scene and hanging out. And I remember we were very touched that he said when he realized we were all writers, he was like, oh, so you guys are all writers too. And we're like, yeah. And he's like, that's why I'm not getting the air of desperation from you guys. Which we always took as like a really nice compliment. Like, oh, he thinks we're just like cool guys. But I was like, it did make me realize like, oh, he's probably on a lot of sets where he just gets a lot of sweaty actors who are coming over to him.
I can only imagine.
But yeah, no, he was a really great guy and like down to earth and very sweet. Yeah.
Well, my last question for you.
Oh, can I tell one more
please
story?
Yes.
So, when the movie wrapped and it came out, I remember I got a call from somebody at my agency who said, hey, we got a package for you in the mail and we opened it up and it's a knife. And they're like, do you know who would have sent this? And then I was like, no. And they're like, well, we had to check it. We have to open stuff up. Like, that seems suspicious. And I got worried because I thought somebody was like mad at me or something. And then they sent it with the card on it. And I opened the card and it was Brad Pitt.
Oh.
He'd give it all the Inglourious Basterds, like these big like hunting knives. It's like a
like
thank
the one
you
he has,
rep
like the
yeah.
deer antler knife.
Yeah. Whatever. So for a while, I thought I had a stalker who wanted to murder me, but it was just a rat present.
It's not out of the realm of possibility that Brad Pitt is stalking you.
Yeah, that's what I'll tell myself. Yeah,
either to love you or to hunt you. But where is that knife now? I hope you have a mantle.
Yes, it's in. Yeah.
So you have a Brad Pitt given deer antler knife on your mantle.
Well, and they didn't open the knife, but it's engraved with the Inglourious Basterds like logo, and then my character's name is engraved on the back, and it was a very thoughtful the guy's a true mensch.
My last question for you is anticlimactic because that story is so good. But did you have any say in your own costume? Because I know sometimes like with these groups they get to kind of be individuals and stuff, and
oh,
do they just hand you that hat and stuff?
Yeah, you know, like Quinn did a really cool thing where we were sitting before we started shooting, we were sitting around the table and like just talking, just the Inglourious Basterds. And I remember him saying, asking everybody what their backstory was. And so we just went around and all shared what we thought our character, where they came from, and who they were. And
I'm so glad I asked this because we can end with this. Do you remember yours at all?
Oh, yeah, because in a a moment of needing something, I just took from my own life, and I was like, he's like from a farm in Iowa. Like, it was like there was no invention whatsoever. I just pulled from my life. And I remember saying, I don't know if farming was part of the Jewish experience. And remember Brad Pitt laughed at that, and then Quentin went, no, there were some Jews who were farmers. Don't worry about it. Like, to make me feel better about my doubt, you know.
So you hadn't done any of that kind of thinking before. You just had to yank it out on the spot.
Yeah. I mean, that was everybody's experience later. Yeah, they were like, were you expecting that?
No. That would be me as well. Oh, man. Paul, I can't thank you enough. This has been one of my favorite interviews.
I love the show. So
thank
you for having me. I was very touched to be asked. So
I feel like I could talk to you hours about this. This has really been one of my favorites. Thank you so much.
Thanks, man. Thanks.
All right.
And now let's wrap things up with a quick round of.
Damn, I wasn't there too.
So it's no surprise that the internet itself is an unending source of lies and deceit, rumor, and fact-mongering. Which is a new term for us here, all of us, the world, the English lexicon. So I try to sort out what I think is just rumor and what seems to be substantiated fact. That being said, I'm not exactly an ace reporter, so take it with a grain of salt. But it does seem to be true that Leonardo DiCaprio was originally up for the role of Hans Landa until Tarantino wanted to go a little bit older with it, and that Donnie Donowitz was originally offered to Adam Sandler, who turned it down to do Funny People. Jean Reno turned down the part for Pierre Lapadite, and there was a scene shot between Donnie Donowitz, Eli Roth, and Cloris Leachman. This scene took place back home in Boston, and rumor has it might be used for a prequel one day. That's the part that strikes me as a little makey-uppy. Hmm? Other rumors include Michael Madsen, Tim Roth as Archie Hickox, Eddie Murphy was apparently in talks with Quentin Tarantino at one point, Natasha Kinski was in talks for the role of Bridget von Hammersmark, even Ennio Morricone was slated to do the movie score before pulling out due to a scheduling conflict. And finally, the hands of Hans Landa weren't even the hands of Hans Landa. When Landa, there are too many broad A's and flat A's in this. Hands of Hans Landa. Hans of Hans Landa. Moses supposes his toes are. The hands of Hans Landa were Quentin Tarantino's when he was choking Bridget von Hammersmark. It's just movie magic. And that wraps up another no-nonsense, how-do-you-do session of... That's it for this episode of I Was There Too. Thanks again to Paul Rust. That was a wonderful conversation. Please review this podcast on iTunes if you get a chance. And as always, if you know somebody or can connect me to a great interview subject for this show, you can reach me at iwasthere2pod@gmail.com. Good night.
Pop.
Wolf Pop is part of Midroll Media, executive produced by Adam Sachs, Matt Gourley, and Paul Scheer.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.